Welcome to Teneo Insights, a podcast that provides in-depth analysis on the issues that matter most to CEOs and their businesses. I'm your host, Kevin Kajiwara, co-president of Teneo's political risk advisory business. Let's get started.
On September 8th of last year, Teneo, the Ford Foundation, the Executive Leadership Council, and a group of founding signatory companies launched the Board Diversity Action Alliance, the BDAA, which is a business-led initiative with an objective of increasing representation of racially and ethnically diverse directors on corporate boards, starting with Black directors. And there's an additional focus on disclosure. And today I'm joined by two of the driving forces and leaders behind the BDAA initiative. Ursula Burns is a Teneo senior advisor, and she serves on the boards of ExxonMobil, Uber, and Nestle, as well as the Ford Foundation, MIT, the Mayo Clinic, and the New York City Ballet. She served as chairman and CEO of the international communications firm Beon. And in 1980, she joined Xerox as an intern, back when Xerox wasn't just a company, it was a verb, and where in 2009, she became the first Black woman to serve as CEO of a Fortune 500 company. Gabrielle Sulzberger recently joined Teneo as a senior advisor, bringing years of corporate governance and financial expertise to the table. She currently serves as a strategic advisor to the New York private equity fund Two Sigma Impact. She serves on a number of boards, including MasterCard, Cerevel Therapeutics, the Ford Foundation, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, Sesame Street Workshop, and Trinity Church Wall Street. Previously, she was the chairman of the board of Whole Foods. Now, after going through all of their bona fides and CVs, we do have a little time left for a discussion here. So, Ursula, let me start with you. You know, you joined me on this program at the time of the founding of the BDAA. And the BDAA and numerous other similar initiatives, clearly were catalyzed by the murder of George Floyd last summer, and numerous other crimes, obviously, that led to a response that ultimately grew into the largest social justice movement in our nation's history. But really, it's rooted in the age-old inequities which persist to this day. But here we are. So a lot has happened since September. It's a new year, a new administration. So give us a sense, in the 6 months or so since the founding, how's it going? How would you describe progress on the fronts that BDAA is meant to address? And are you encouraged by what you're seeing?
I would start first with how I'm feeling. And I said back then, 6 or so months ago, that I was optimistic. And I remain optimistic and probably incrementally more optimistic than I was even 6 months ago. What happens when you have a reasonable idea? You get copycats. And in this case, that's a very, very good thing that we weren't the first people who thought about board diversity by any stretch of the imagination. But since the BDAA, we've gotten additional signatories. That effort is going extremely well. As you know, we were focused on the large corporates, the larger corporates, and not on private equity and VC, which I think Gabby will tell you a little bit more about later. I would say that we're doing very well. Companies are signing up, and even if they're not signing up, they're doing their own things in response to other initiatives like California, continued pressure from the UK, the NASDAQ communications on, if you don't have a diverse board, we're not going to list you. So there's a lot of activity going on that is focusing the energies and the actions of corporations in this area around board and leadership diversity. So it's good. The tone, the government is chiming in. The new administration is definitely chiming in support, not specifically of the BDAA. They haven't said that or anything specifically, but with diversity overall, board diversity and leadership diversity. So I think that we have, as I talked before, I didn't want this to become a moment. I wanted it to be a movement stolen from the Hamilton, the play. And I think we have the beginnings, the strong beginnings of a movement. Now, this is not just you know, let's do this and get this off our back. I don't think we are at the point where we can take our attention away. It doesn't have enough momentum yet to not be nurtured along, but it is definitely moving in the right direction. And I'll leave it to Gabby to talk about some other areas that we found that need a push. But for the initial focus of the BDAA and the initial plank, which was at least one Black or brown director on every board, we're making progress there. So it's good. We still have a lot of work to do. Like I said, I just don't want us to take our eyes off of it, but we've made progress.
So, you bring up the UK, and I just wanted to highlight that there was sort of a sobering story that just hit Bloomberg this morning that was indicating that on the FTSE 100 now, there are no Black chairman, CEOs, or CFOs for the first time in 6 years. But before I turn it over to Gabby, I wanted to follow up with one thing here, Ursula. At the time of the launch, you know, you talked about one of the things that really motivated you on this front beyond the events of last summer themselves was that, you know, in the aftermath of them, you were fielding a lot of calls.
Yes.
From a lot of executives, not just in the U.S., but frankly, globally, imploring you for guidance on what to do. And I guess my question here is, are you still fielding these calls?
Are
these executives and boards, are they walking the talk from last year?
So the calls are obviously fewer. They are they've already made one or two rounds of calls, so there's not a need to call as much as before. But there are lots of conversations happening. That's one of the positive things as well. On every board that I sit on, but also in business gatherings, which all happen in the way that we're doing a business gathering now, by Zoom or whatever other form, this is a topic that is on every single conversation that I'm having everywhere, which is the board diversity, not just Black or Latinx in the U.S., but racial diversity and female around the world. So this is a topic that every company understands is not something they can dodge anymore. They can't kind of not talk about it. That's also good. What we're seeing is that people are absolutely, and even it's a short time, Radina Russell, who's doing a lot of the statistics for us and a lot of the help here at Teneo on this, in a short time, we've gone from like 2% to 12%. So the numbers are moving even in this very short time. I will just reiterate, we are way far from being over, but we are seeing people not backing away yet, not everyone, obviously. There's some companies that are just bad actors, but most companies are trying to understand a way to at least comply if affirmatively do the right thing. And that's very useful and very, very helpful. So the conversations are still happening. Like I said, on every business call I have, we do not have a call that doesn't have something to do with diversity. Part of the reason for that, by the way, is that we don't let it, somebody in the room brings it up. It's either me or someone else brings up, you know, how are we doing? What are we thinking about, et cetera. So if we can keep that focus, that would be helpful. But let me make one other comment on this FTSE thing. I did read it this morning. Not surprising. You know, one of the things that's really interesting in the UK, in Europe in general, but in the UK, is that they focused first on gender diversity. This is something that we found in the United States as well, because it's a little bit of an easier hill to climb. There's a lot more comfort with white women in particular. And so we found that a lot of boards check the diversity box if they're pushed in that way, and they check that box by bringing white women on the board. By the way, that's not something that I say we should stop doing. I think it's part of the success factor. But in order to be truly diverse, we have to deal with the elephant in the room, which is the lack of racial and largely cultural diversity on many, many boards. So good for the women, still have a long way to go to move forward there, but success will not be called if all you have is a set of women on your board and white women and white men on the board. You still have to get the rest of the world represented in a reasonable way.
Yeah, I just want to so thoroughly agree with this comment, you know, as it relates to what's going on in the UK. And I think the only other thing I'd add to that, you know, is yes, it's distressing that we are, you know, a kind of a low watermark in this last 6 year period. But I just want to add that that low watermark was not very high before. So even if we look like where it was 6 years ago, the fact that we're worse off than we were 6 years ago, and we were in a crappy place, like that, I think there's really a larger problem. And something that Ursula says that for the statistics and numbers to be that bad, it doesn't happen by accident. You know, it's like, you know, you almost have to work at it. And so, you know, I'm not sure. I'm sure, you know, it's a complex situation, but clearly there's a lack of intent for there to be zero. You know, there is at best a lack of intent that, you know, at this moment in time is particularly discouraging. And then the other thing I want to say, you know, with regard to kind of what we're seeing and her comments with regard to engagement, you know, I just think that's so critical. And, you know, after kind of the events of the summer, you know, one of the things that I did was in some cases, my CEOs reached out to me, but in even cases where they didn't, I reached out to them and, you know, and said, look, you know, I'm the only person of color on your board, which was the case 99% of the time, you know, you know, we've been working together. If there's any questions that you have or thoughts or concerns or, you know, and I found in some ways that was the ones who hadn't reached out to me that was most important for me to reach out to, because, you know, I think one of the things that happened was like they had kind of this new awareness. And in some cases, it's because they were living with their college students, you know, because of COVID, you know, in other cases, like, you know, kind of employed. It's, for whatever reason, kind of this light bulb went off and they realized the extent. To fully realize this is still really an issue. And there was a discomfort they had in talking about it and in really engaging. And they needed to have and have, you know, kind of opportunity to have like kind of really safe conversation, you know, about the issue and get grounded and centered themselves. And so to me, that was one of the more encouraging bits, to the extent to which, you know, it happened in my own boards and I'm hearing about it happening other places, that, you know, this as a topic and an issue is no longer being ignored. You know, if it's being raised by the people of color or the people, you know, or non-people of color, it is clearly such a, you know, it's an issue now that people are having to talk about and engage in. And I think the conversations themselves are extremely valuable because the conversations weren't happening before. And if we're not even in dialogue about it, nothing's going to happen. So I have been encouraged by the conversation. And, you know, it's early days, like there's no doubt, but at least on the boards and organizations I'm working with directly, the depth of commitment around it and the longer term multi-year commitments that, you know, these companies have been making, you know, also I find really both encouraging, important, not it, like the kind of differentiating between the, like, you know, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to check this box. We're going to check this box. What I'm hearing and kind of encouraging is multi-year, longer term commitments with accountability, you know, year to year to year. And I think that's part of the kind of, I think the value and the importance of what we've done with BDAA is not only kind of accomplishing these very specific, you know, goals around, you know, board diversity, but accountability and transparency, because in the longer term, you know, that's really the important piece. And I think one of the things, if, you know, we kind of turn to this notion of, you know, kind of what we're seeing in, you know, kind of, you know, private companies and venture capital and private equity, you know, is different, which is, you know, private equity and venture, these are industries that were born of kind of an interest in not being transparent. And so they've been operating for decades, you know, quite successfully on some, you know, metrics. by being below the radar screen and not being held accountable, you know, and not being transparent, you know, even as much as, you know, public companies are. And so, you know, kind of no surprise when they are, when we do start like kind of looking under the hood or, you know, under the kimono, what we see is not great. And so, you know, Ursula mentioned initially, we really very much focused on, you know, larger public companies. Over this last several months, we have turned our attention to Silicon Valley and the private equity industry, and have done, you know, some pretty thorough work, primarily around what their portfolio companies look like when they go public, because that is the moment when, you know, we have access to a lot of a lot of information, you know, through their, you know, through the various filings. And so when we look at the performance, and we looked at about over 20 of the largest kind of name that you've all heard of, private equity and venture funds, and we've looked at them and cut, kind of sliced and diced it over in 5-year increments over the last 20 years. When we look at those, you know, close to 900 portfolio companies that went public and created trillions and trillions of dollars in, you know, wealth, the numbers that we see with regard to executives, Black executives, Black and Latinx executives in the C-suite and on their boards is, I don't know, again, as Ursula said, it's not an accident. You know, there are major venture capital funds for whom you, the number is zero. And that's pretty remarkable over a 20-year period.
Absolutely. And I want to pivot here a little bit. And Ursula, you brought up something in your initial comments with regards to the what you're hearing out of the administration. You know, President Biden, both on the campaign trail and in his inaugural address about American leadership, you know, not characterized by the example of its power, but rather by the power of its example. You know, much has been made, often by the administration itself, that this is the most diverse administration in history. I guess the proof is in the numbers, but Ursula, are you impressed by that claim? Are you pleased with what you're seeing so far in this transition? And what are you expecting?
I am. I don't know the facts of the claim. You know, I haven't studied whether or not they are. It is actually the most diverse. I don't know. I think that what I've seen, I am pleased with, particularly in the mix of people, not only obviously men and women, and not only Black, but also Latinx, and just, you know, people from very different backgrounds. So I'm pleased with that. I'm a little bit worried about the lack of business representation in Biden's cabinet. I'm sure that he's tried to get some business reps in, but that's some place that we're going to I think that all of us on this call, when called for support in thinking through issues with the administration, which I'm sure many of your companies will be. I know that I was often when I was at Xerox. It's going to be important that we pitch in, because the cabinet doesn't have a natural voice in it. But the rest of the diversity, I think, is pretty good. One thing that's important, I think that we learned this under Obama, is that people actually thought, including Black people, that since we had a Black president, the war was over. I mean, that, you know, people say, you don't have to worry about it. You know, all the issues are going to be handled. We have a Black vice president, female now. Trust me, if these people could have fixed the problems that we're talking about in their own rights, they would have done that. It's still going to take a large amount of work for progress to be made, despite the fact that we have a Black female Black vice president. On both the female front and the African-American front, it's going to take a lot more effort than just this one person. But I think generally so far, early days, I am on the traditional diversity. I am pretty, I think, okay, I would like more business people sitting around the table.
Interesting. And Gabby, I'm interested to hear your thoughts on this as well. But in addition, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement posed obviously a challenge to corporate America to not just say the right thing, but as we have been discussing thus far, you know, to close that gap between ambition and actual action. And then soon enough, of course, The election itself posed a challenge, and the aftermath, and certainly January 6th, the insurrection at the Capitol did as well. And we saw this immediate, you know, we saw some immediate financial consequences in terms of corporate political donations to the GOP and to certain members of Congress. So this had to be a year of some serious whiplash for corporate America. I guess I'm wondering if you think anything has actually changed and will permanently change for them politically, or do you expect that things are ultimately just going to revert back to sort of, let's call it, K Street normal?
Yeah. Well, so first of all, in the former, you know, I am also, it's early days. I mean, it's, I guess we're not even at the first official month yet. But I am also encouraged. I think it's what I've read is that this is the first gender balanced cabinet that the United States has seen. And so that's positive. It's something like a quarter of the cabinet's Black. So, you know, I think that our president has made some really positive statements, and it is no panacea, but I do think it's encouraging. I think the second question you've asked is in some ways it's a harder one. But I think, you know, part of the way I think about it is, you know, over this last period, and it's driven, you know, Larry Fink and, you know, some large, you know, institutional shareholders have really encouraged and pushed our boards and companies to think more broadly about, you know, what is our responsibility as corporations. We're the beneficiaries of huge entitlements, and so what does that mean, and how do we think of ourselves, you know, kind of from an accountability perspective, and you know, our social responsibilities, and, you know, is it enough to only, you know, be you know, accountable to shareholders? And I think that there is this kind of grow, there's a kind of an increase of awareness instead of understanding that answer is no. That, you know, for a company to truly serve its shareholders, you have to have kind of a consciousness around the broader stakeholders we serve in our communities. And so, you know, as it relates then, you know, to this kind of Black Lives Matter and these kind of really structural issues that have been raised, I think the train has left the station, this idea that we can kind of turn a blind eye. You know, this pandemic, unemployment has doubled. Now, I think like the last, you know, I read something like 35% of, you know, of people between the ages of 30 and 50 have had at least one person in their household lose their job, you know, and we know that this disproportionately has affected, you know, people of color. So the extent to which this, you know, affects the communities in which we operate, our employees, our customers, like, I don't, how you could not, as a board member, you know, as an executive, kind of think about the ways, even if you're just mostly, you know, you're kind of narrowly thinking about, you know, business impacts, not understanding and being thoughtful about kind of what this means to your enterprise, you know, is not fully, you know, responsible.
Whenever we speak, one of I love this kind of a question, which is, so is it working? Has it worked? What can we do? I think one of the most important things is that things just don't happen by happenstance. People have to engage to actually have change happen, particularly if it's difficult, right? And I think that everybody, all of the business leaders, people on this phone, the people who sit on boards, has to be engaged here. It will not work. We will not make progress if we allow progress to not be made. We will make progress if we continue to agitate. That's not only on race and gender, it's on sustainability efforts, it's on all kinds of things. We have to, as board members, as consumers, as citizens of wherever we are, we have to actually speak up. We can't sit back and say, well, they, you know, they're not doing it. It's not happening. They're not taking care of it. They are us. And so I continually just plead that we don't leave it to other people to actually control our destiny, that we actually get engaged on all these subjects. Talk to your board, if you're employed, make it clear that this is something that you're paying attention to. Oh, these things are things that you're paying attention to, things that you're interested in. And I think that's what's happening. You know, that's what's happening with some of the younger employees at, you know, Google and Facebook, mm-hmm. who are, you know, having internal disruption, equal to internal disruption as they have external disruption, because their employees are saying no more.
Right.
So Ursula, you bring up something really interesting here, I think, because obviously the events of the last year and with the election, with the Black Lives Matter movement and social justice movements, obviously then with within the umbrella of the economic impact, the pandemic, the rise of China, all of these things. Clearly, and the fact that we're all at home and actually get to think about some of this stuff. One of the hallmarks of an open and sophisticated intellect, I think, is the ability to change one's mind in the face of new facts and realities. And one of the most remarkable corporate stories just emerged here in the last month, right? And that's General Motors, where after joining the Trump administration's pushback on California emission standards, the CEO, Mary Barra, stunned the street last week with a strategy to phase out the internal combustion engine in the face of climate change science, in the face of ESG increasing increasingly the norm and increasing pressure, in the face of Tesla, let's say. Do you expect more big kind of dramatic announcements like this coming from some of the traditional big blue chip companies? And what are the implications then that have to be thought second order? I mean, the auto industry is a benchmark here, obviously. You sit on the board of Exxon. That's going to have implications for the energy industry, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I think that I say hooray to Mary Barra, not necessarily because I'm all for phasing out the internal combustion engine. I say hooray because she actually studied the facts, the direction that the wind is blowing, her and her team and her board, and came to a conclusion that normal course would probably not be a long-term way to success here. By the way, she could probably have run this company for many, and her successors for many, 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 many years, but doing the same thing. But I think that, you know, changing your mind and learning from science that's presenting itself, in this case, it's climate science, presenting itself clearly, et cetera, et cetera. I think I give her tons of credit, and her board and her management team. I do. And if you paid attention last week, ExxonMobil just announced that they are going, the significant investments that they are going to make in non-carbon based fuels. Another shocker. It's like, really? I mean, this is a molecule company. That's what they do. But literally standing up, you know, and spending billions of dollars to create a new future, not only for the company, but for the world. So I think that the answer is absolutely. We're going to see more and more. It may not be public, but you will see more and more companies literally thinking about being waste neutral, plastic neutral. You know, you hear it all over. We're starting to pay a little bit more attention to the reality that's been facing us for a long time. Having an administration that won't punish you is helpful, by the way, but it's not necessary to do it. You know, it's helpful. And I think that we'll see even more because we have an administration now that actually will probably punish you if you don't take progressive steps towards the environment and towards a new future for the world. So I think that the answer, and I think Gabby said it, you know, you can't be kind of like dumb here. The fact, you know, there's like some things that the tea leaves are, they're like not even tea leaves anymore. There's big black letters in front of every CEO and every company around sustainability, around diversity. You know, there's some things you just cannot avoid anymore. And if you think you can just hold your breath until it goes away, you know, if I were an investor, I would actually not be for long, because it's not going to be, there's certain things that are not going to turn.
And Ursula, don't you think part of one of the things that I think is interesting and with kind of a little more, you know, kind of with a broader white space on this, you know, the extent to which companies are kind of thinking about this strategically, right? Yeah. They're not just like, you know, this is kind of a nice thing to do. I'm just like, I'm going to check now my social responsibility box. But understanding that this is like the strategically kind of the right direction and right set of decisions. And that's true, you know, with regard to ESG. It's true, you know, kind of with regard to diversity. Like, we're not doing this because it's a nice thing, because, like, you know, we want to be good people. We want to get to heaven. Like strategically, these are important long-term decisions. complicated ones, but important for the health and the growth of the business.
Yeah, you said it. You said it. The writing is on the wall. And I'm not talking about the writing that you're going to go to heaven or wherever you go, whatever. It's the writing of, we see what's happening to the planet. We see what the future consumers are focused on. We see what the realities of just a talent deficit. And if you think you can keep picking from this smaller and smaller pool of white males, you're going to be in trouble. Everything we see it, and businesses strategically are thinking about it as well. And with cover, and I mean, this is good cover from shareholders who actually say, no, we are not going to beat your head against a wall if you miss by a penny or you spend too much on whatever. We actually want you to report not only on how much revenue you generate and how much profit you make. We want you to report on how sustainable your company is. We want you to report on the diversity and equity of your employee base and your supplier base and et cetera. So investors are saying enough is enough as well. And, you know, people like Larry Fink, great. But all of the pension funds are starting to climb on board. It's actually unavoidable. And it is strategic, right? Because, like, as you said, you can't avoid it. It's big black letters now.
I think the other thing, and you and I have talked about this, our children are all millennials, right? Yeah. The millennial, the millennials are not standing by, you know, they have kind of a completely different, you know, set of sensibilities about, and as they grow in increasing clout, not just as consumers, but, you know, in our workforce, the writing on the wall is, if you're not thinking about this, because guaranteed these millennials, They are.
And I tell you what, Gabby and everybody on the phone, the more privilege, I have two children and they're obviously come a little bit different than me from a privileged background. You know, they great schools, a lot of access to a lot of great things. And you would think that they would be softer on the topics. It's just the opposite. It is absolutely insane how focused and critical and engaged they are. To change the current narrative, to make the world a different place. So you're so right. We can't, if you are at home with, and which we all are now, if they happen to be home, these kids will not give you a break. They are, you know, you're not going to leave us a bigger mess than necessary. Please clean it up as much as you can before you go.
Personal, let me ask you something about not the millennials, but the next generations after that, because, you know, so much of the conversation we've had today has been focused on increasing diversity in the workplace, particularly at the leadership levels and the pipeline of people that are ultimately going to get to those leadership levels. And, you know, one of the sort of paradoxes of this past year with this large social justice movement is that it came in the context also of the pandemic. And one of the effects of the pandemic has been a widening again of the digital divide, a widening of which kids, in high school and younger are getting the quality of education that they were already getting pre-pandemic, right? And, you know, who's got the technology at home? Who's got all of this ability to learn virtually? And it seems to me that the divisions that are being created here, whether you're in kindergarten or, a junior, senior in high school, we're going to deal with the ramifications of that for years to come as people either try to get to college and are competing against those who were able to get the level of education they were expecting during this time, or get those first jobs. How worried are you about what's happening on that front right now?
Yeah, not more worried than I would normally be, which is very worried, right? So, but I'm not panicking right now. What's happened during the pandemic is that we've done something good, and that's that we've took the cover off of something that was happening no matter what. You know, it was happening anyway. We just didn't pay a lot of attention to it. When I say we, I mean collective we. We're not paying enough attention to it. The digital divide existed. If you, both Gabby and I serve on the Ford Foundation board, this is something that we talk a lot about, the number of people who actually have no access, even through the pandemic, So I think that in some ways this is a positive thing. Not that not the people affected is not positive for them, but it's positive for the people who can affect change. One, to bring bring visibility and transparency to the fact that this problem really exists. It really exists. It's now exacerbated by the fact that everybody is at home. Number two, that there are things that can be done. There's all of these startups, little activities. Now we have to catalyze our efforts behind them to help to close this thing. And the third is that you can get involved. It doesn't require, you know, millions of dollars and you know, traveling millions of miles. Locally, we can get involved and we can help. And I think that while it is not pleasant or positive for the affected, it's now positive for the change that we can start and have, because now more people is in everybody's face every day. And so I'm hoping that this, just like the raid on the Capitol building, brings to light that we had a level of tyranny that we were bubbling up and people had to see it before they could actually do something about it. Same thing here. We have a fundamental inequality that we're going to pay for. We're going to pay for, no matter what you think, no matter how rich you are, we're going to pay for this, either in incarceration rates or in welfare rates or whatever. We're going to lack of health, good health outcomes, if we don't get in the middle of it right now. And it was happening before, and now at least there's a light on it, so we can hopefully do something more about it. And hope is not a good strategy. So just, I say always get engaged. We were talking earlier about how busy we all are, but not busy enough to actually lend a little bit of a hand.
Ursula, I want to take it back, though, what both you and Gabby have just been talking about, and go back to the GM thing for just a second, because it reminds me that, you know, the auto sector and its suppliers are the largest manufacturing sector in the country. It's another sector now that's going to continue to displace workers in a sense, right? And so I'm wondering, what is the corporate role here in re-educating and retraining workers, right? I mean, the human capital infrastructure of the country is in flux. So the pandemic has shown us that if you're a university educated person, I mean, that's one of the easiest ways to determine whether somebody has been able to weather the pandemic well versus not weather the pandemic well, is whether you were college educated or whatnot. However, the workforces of manufacturing America are going to be dependent on their employees being, you know, properly trained and properly located for the work that needs to be done. So this can't be just left to the education system. Corporate America has to engage on this front as well to prepare that pipeline. What are your thoughts?
Absolutely.
On that?
I think that there was an announcement yesterday on a commission that was formed on inclusive capitalism. It's to try to redefine, you know, we all love capitalism, but we have some pretty big missteps in the current practice of capitalism. One of them is that workers are not valued. Capital is valued. Workers are valued significantly less. And there's a whole bunch of statistics about, you know, growth in market valuations, growth in C-suite pay, growth in everything. And over the last, 15 years, the pay of a worker has gone up by, 15%. That's over the whole time. And it's thousands of percent in market valuation and tens of thousands of percent in CEO pay. One of the fundamental responsibilities that a company has is to assure that its workers are ready for not only today, but for the future. I don't think that companies have to educate somebody to read, right? That stuff is, and write and do basic arithmetic. That's what we pay taxes for in most of our jurisdictions. But the world is changing. Technology is driving the need for continuous change and therefore continuous education. And the responsibility of that is jointly held by the employee and the employer. It's something that employers have been failing on. There are some companies who do a great job on this. A company like AT&T, who has to train linemen and women who go up on these lines. They actually train people to do this. It is the responsibility of business to be responsible for the lifeline, for the lifetime learning of the employee while they're there, even though that employee is probably going to be more mobile.
I got to ask you both, since I've got you here, you both represent significant corporate boards. You know, as we embark on this new year, as Gabby pointed out, the vaccine programs, but we've got obviously a pandemic that continues to rage in the country. We've got significant economic dislocations. We have got unlocked gridlock as yet in Washington on the next round of fiscal stimulus and the like. What are you on your respective boards hearing from your managements and their advisors on the economic prospects for this year? What are you anticipating at kind of a macro level?
Interestingly enough, most of the signals and news is good. I am shocked by this, by the way, but this also presents the difference between Wall Street and Main Street. Right? There is an expectation that the second half of the year will come, since we now have a set of vaccines in hand, that the second half of the year will stimulate consumer confidence and growth. All of the companies that I'm engaged with, you know, ExxonMobil specifically, price of oil driven company, but fundamental operations really good. Most of the companies I'm engaged with are prepared, ready, and optimistic for 2021 and beyond. It's like I said, a little different from what most people are feeling when you see them in the street. But companies I don't believe are overly nervous. They are a little nervous about, you know, actions in Washington or actions, global actions or actions in the UK, those kinds of things. But that's normal business operations. As far as their normal P&L prospects, I think that they believe 2021 and beyond is going to be, particularly the second half, is going to be a good year.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, are you concerned at all in your board positions? You know, you talk about, Ursula talked about this division now between the way that Wall Street versus the way that Main Street is feeling. But, you know, we've continued to see after the economic dislocations of the last year, the market continues to, you know, head toward new highs. The Fed has indicated that rates are not going up anytime soon. They're continuing to push a wall of money at business. And real rates are negative. So the market keeps going up. From a corporate governance perspective, are you at all concerned that the price discovery mechanism of the market has gotten somewhat corrupted here? Does that influence corporate behavior?
Yeah, this is something I think a lot about, Kevin, I have to say I'm concerned about it, but I'm not really sure yet how to think through it, if you know what I mean. If it were sector specific or geography specific, I would say that for sure that there is an issue, if you know what I mean. But this is everywhere, every sector. And so something I keep, you know, rolling around in my head before I come to a conclusion on what's really happening here. And it's been going on for so long. This is 10 years, right? It's been going on for so long that there may be something else happening here. I don't know. I do tell you that Gabby mentioned this, I think. It was a little broken up, but boards are thinking about this as well. They're optimists, but they are absolutely, just about every single meeting, we have this pause that's like, but, you know, this tailwind almost can't last forever. You know, essentially free money, very high level of risk appetite. You know, there's a whole bunch of things that generally come in cycles, and this is one of the longest cycles that we've had. So I'm not totally sure, because like I said, it's been going on for a long time and it's across just about every industry and every geography, that maybe there's something else structural going on. But boards, at least the ones that I'm on, and I hear it just from walking around and talking to people, not that I walk a lot anymore, but talking to people, that literally every board is worried about, or thinking, worried is not a good word, but thinking about, you know, this reality of today. Is this reality of today going to last for very much longer?
I want to pivot for just a couple minutes here for the last few minutes that we've got left, because both of you sit, as I mentioned at the beginning, on the boards of significant and iconic American cultural institutions. Gabby on the Metropolitan Museum in New York, and Ursula on the New York City Ballet. Because the arts in this country have obviously, and frankly globally, have been significantly impacted by all of the things that we're talking about today. Financially impacted, to be sure, but also on the broader issue of diversity and inclusion, and frankly, you know, both of your institutions in the fine and performing arts presentation areas, you know, have a compelling place in telling the nation's narrative, right? And some institutions have taken this opportunity and have made great strides. Others have had very publicly traumatic experiences on this front, like the Guggenheim Museum here in New York. So maybe your thoughts, Gabby, I can start with you on how all of this is impacting the cultural institutions of the country and how you're moving forward through this.
You know, for example, at the Met, because of, you know, safety concerns and COVID requirements and so forth, we're limited to 25% visits. But fortunately, through this time, we are at max on these visitations. And when we opened our doors in August, we were overwhelmed by, you know, how we were welcomed by the community. So clearly the role of culture, you know, is, you know, important and through all these communities and has made, and because of the financial pressure on these institutions that, you know, COVID has created, you know, they are now facing, you know, almost in many cases, existential challenges. That said, they also, in our experience, they've been really like, it's been kind of a day of reckoning on, you know, some of, you know, these issues and, you know, for institutions that have been, I don't know, challenged for decades, right? So, you know, one of the statistics I've seen is that when you a survey of the top 20 major cultural institutions, it's less than 2% of the artists' works are by African American artists, right? So, you know, kind of this as a kind of this lack, this extreme lack of diversity with regard to the content of what museums exhibit and therefore the narratives that, you know, are shared and validated, you know, is clearly a systemic problem. So, but particularly, you know, exacerbated then in the context, you know, of this pandemic. So, you know, we began some work last fall. We formed an organization, actually an alliance of Black trustees of all the major arts museums. We've been meeting over the course of the fall to develop kind of a platform and a set of resources for Black trustees of major museums, all of whom are facing, you know, really kind of similar, you know, issues with regard to lack of curators and developing curatorial talent, lack of, you know, diversity in senior leadership. So a really organized effort to one, make us be more effective trustees, but two, then be a resource to one another and to these institutions who truly are grappling with these issues, but grappling with them at a time of, you know, when they are under, you know, even the Met, you know, like due to significant financial stress. And so trying to address these issues around diversity now is more of a challenge, but all the more important.
And you representing the Met, I mean, at least it's a very large place. You can actually accommodate a lot of people in there safely under the guidelines of the city right now. And obviously one of the most richly endowed cultural institutions in the world. Ursula, you represent the performing arts, and that's a much tougher situation right now. What are you hearing in terms of when you'll be back, when your company will be back on stage at Lincoln Center?
Yeah, it'll be a while. We are hoping that we can start to get some level of interaction with other humans on the middle to the this year to the, you know, third quarter of this year. We're hoping that that's the case. And our issue is very different than the Mets. The Met can let 25% people, you know, they can let people in, even if it's only 25%. The New York City Ballet has basically, we've gone to performing on video. You know, you've done everything that you can to keep the art alive. But this is very, very, very dire for the Met. For the ballet, fortunately, it has a series of benefactors that are closing some of the gap, but nowhere near. This is an organization that if they made a dollar yesterday, they make $0 today, and they have very skilled humans. What I said earlier in one of my previous calls like this is that it's important that we all find our organization, whatever that is. It could be the Y or whatever it is, and in your community, to pay attention to it and help it through this time with extra donations or whatever you can do. Because if we don't support them and they cannot make it through this time, there is really no going back, if you know what I mean. You can't say, okay, we're going to disband. This will never happen, but we're going to disband the Whitney. It's not going to happen, or the Met's not going to exist because it doesn't have any money. And, oh, next week we actually are out of pandemic, so let's start it again. Some of these things are, the Apollo is one of these things I'm very concerned about, and it's been doing well from benefactors. If these things go, they will not be able to come back. It's really important that we understand that we have to give disproportionately attention and probably money to these organizations. The Met needs it, but so does the little museum around the corner. All, you know, the Tenement Museum absolutely needs it. These places will go away if we don't help them through this time. So we have to absolutely help them, even if we don't go to visit them.
Well, and these institutions also, particularly with the performing arts, they play an important role for these artists, these dancers, yep, these musicians who don't have big safety nets or safe, you know, being out of work or in furlough for, you know, this is a huge, huge hardship. So even if the, you know, you thought like, oh, we're going to turn the lights back on, you know, these folks have been out of work. And yep, so
it's dire, Gabby. It really, really is. I mean, it is. It's something that we all have to pay attention to. The good news is that while the last administration was in and he literally vilified the arts and said he was going to cut funding, he actually didn't cut it as much as he said he was going to cut it. So that's good. But the pandemic then layered on top a total lack of traffic. I mean, it's just not enough traffic and not enough time to practice. Even curators are, you know, it's just, it's hard. They need money. They need money. They need support.
Even in relatively wealthy places, again, who this has disproportionately affected has been employees of color. So even the Met, as hard as we've worked because of decreased attendance, you know, some of the areas that we've cut operating costs have been, for example, security, you know, restaurants, and that's where a large percent of our diverse employees were. So again, it's affecting all communities, you know, and then it's, you know, surprising in some of the ways that it's disproportionately affecting communities of color.
So there you have it. I'm Kevin Kachawara. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Teneo Insights. If you have any questions about any of the topics we cover, please reach out to us at teneoinsights@teneo.com. See you next time.